We've gathered once again before a live audience in Marion this time, some looking forward to a Trump presidency, others filled with Trump trepidation. I'm Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio News. This is a special edition of River to River. It's Pints and Politics.
And I'm the Gazette Opinion Editor, Jennifer Hemmingson, and we have got a lot to talk about tonight.
We have James Lynch of the Gazette. Investigative and political reporter, along with Gazette columnists Linda Waddington. And seated next to her is Todd Dorman. And you know, this is really nice. We're in a because we're at the Giving Tree Theater, we're in a living room that is from I don't know what play. But I looked on the coffee table over here, Jennifer. Did you notice what book is on the coffee table?
Is it the Holy Bible?
That may be fitting. This is an Ernest Hemingway book we all know. Yes, you're laughing. For Whom the Bell Tolls. The bowl.
For Whom the Bell Tolls.
For Whom the Bell Tolls.
And the bell tolled loud and clear on Tuesday on election night, surprising a lot of folks.
In an unexpected tone. It did. So I've got a question. We were, before we started this show, we always like to go to questions later in the hour, Jennifer, but if you'll forgive me, I'd like to start off with a question because I think it sums up what some people are thinking ever since the election results came in. And I can say this on the radio. We've checked with the FCC. This is a question from our audience for our panelists to lead off. What the hell happened?
All the questions are the same, aren't they?
Who wants to tackle that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, specifically all the polls going in showed a much different picture than what folks woke up to on Wednesday. James, did you see that coming at all?
No. All the polls that I was looking at were fairly close when you look at the state-by-state breakdowns. So it seemed like there was an outside chance of Trump winning, but I guess I assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to win. Although in late afternoon when I was looking at the results coming in from Florida and Trump was ahead and then Clinton pulled ahead a little bit, but it was very, very close in Florida, it just struck me that this is probably not going to be over early. It's going to be a long night if it's that close in Florida as the early results are coming in. So, yeah, surprised. Maybe close to shocked, but certainly surprised at the outcome.
Well, let's talk specifically about the polls real quick, because the polls were consistent. They were dramatically different from what we saw. So was it a problem with the polls? And we also had talked about there were so many polls. Was that a problem in itself?
I don't know if I can answer the question about was the methodology wrong. And there are a lot of questions about polling now because of the landline, cell lines, cell phones. You know, do you reach the right audience? Do you reach a representative audience? Who answers the phone? You know, I mean, I don't answer the phone if I don't recognize the number. So, you know, your pool of people who respond to polls is small. And pollsters will tell you they tend to be older people who are home and aren't afraid of answering their phone. I think one of the things that has sort of emerged after the election, we started to see a little bit before the election, is the Trump supporters who didn't speak up, didn't say they were for Trump, either weren't polled because they hadn't voted in the past, perhaps, or when they were polled, they didn't say they were voting for Trump. There was an interesting piece a while back about the difference between polls with live operators and the polls with online, and Trump did better in every online poll than he did in the live interviews, suggesting that people weren't willing to tell another person that they were voting for Trump, but online, the anonymity, they were willing to say they were voting for Trump, and that unspoken support may be what made the difference.
I just wanted to say that I have a Facebook friend who I will not out here tonight who did vote for Trump. And today was on Facebook bragging about how he lied to pollsters. He enjoyed being an Asian female. He enjoyed being a Hispanic male. He enjoyed revisiting his youth. So every time a pollster called, he just told them whatever was on his mind and made up a story for them. So I think as long as you're relying on people to tell you the truth, I think there's always an opportunity for people to tell you whatever they want to tell you.
media tended to focus on the extreme Trump supporters, the KKK, the folks who I can assume a lot of people wouldn't want to be associated with. And we've been hearing throughout the campaign from people who said, nobody's listening to me, you know, my voice isn't being heard here. Is that something that the results of the election has proven then to basically be true, that there is, in fact, a silent majority of people who have been a little bit left out of the conversation and Trump tapped into that?
You know, I'm not willing to label them the silent majority because I think that's actually kind of a backhand slam against this group of people. But I do have permission from my brother to tell a little bit of his story. And his story being that he is a machinist for an oil company in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and has consistently seen his wages fall, has consistently seen changes within his industry that he blames on a government. And definitely in this election, he was looking to lash out at that, you know, that he wanted to make a statement that he is valuable. And it's not necessarily that he is saying that Black lives don't matter or that any of these other things aren't true, but he feels lost in the shuffle.
Jennifer, let's do a couple clapping polls, because I'd like to find it. We have to realize that our audience here at the Giving Tree Theater in Marion is in one of the counties, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the six counties in Iowa that voted for Clinton. Okay? See? I didn't even ask them to clap, and they did, you see? That's how pro-Clinton it is here in this county. One of six counties of 99 counties that went for Clinton. Clap if you have real hope that Donald Trump may unify this country. Okay? Clap if you have real anxiety about what Donald Trump may do as president. Clap if you've had to comfort someone who is distraught about the results. We've heard about the Not Our President protests spreading across the country. Clap if you will consider Donald Trump not your president. Clap if you oppose Trump, but you are willing to wait and see what Trump does to give him a chance as president.
Well, and in fact, Ben, we saw that even at the exit polls, people who voted for Donald Trump weren't totally sure that they liked him very much. His unfavorables were higher than the folks who said they voted for him. And again, we could have that disconnect between people willing to say what people are willing to tell a stranger and what they really feel in their hearts. But what does a President Trump have to do to unify those folks who voted for him who are still not totally sure about him and the folks who voted against him who are unsure to petrified on that spectrum?
Well, it certainly can't be one conciliatory speech, which is all we've gotten. I think you have to have a cabinet that's a very thoughtful cabinet. I think you have to have a chief of staff who's a very thoughtful chief of staff. Unfortunately, I heard today that he's looking at Mr. Bannon from the alt-right media as his chief of staff, which doesn't send the right signal, at least in my opinion, on what he's going to do. But you know, I think there has to be more than one speech, because at least here in Iowa, we have now had roughly 2 years of some pretty extreme rhetoric from this campaign. And you don't overcome that with one speech. And at this point, I think a lot of people are waiting to see actions and not necessarily words.
I think, you know, the onus really is on Trump at this point, and Linda is absolutely right. The people he starts bringing into his administration and the appointing to cabinet positions, if he appoints women, people of color, if he would, nominate a Muslim for a cabinet position, it would send a great signal to America that he really is inclusive, that all that stuff he talked, you know, a Hispanic. Imagine if he nominated a Hispanic to one of the cabinet positions. It would send a signal to America that the election is over and that we're ready to, you know, work, be a working administration for the whole country.
Fat chance shouted from the audience.
And you know, this his margin for error is probably less than his supporters. I mean, think, this is a super close election. I mean, you look at, I think I was reading on some analysis that, you know, if two out of every 100 votes had sort of switched, one way or the other. I mean, it would have been a totally different map. It looks like he's probably on the way to losing the popular vote. I mean, if he doesn't deliver fairly quickly on some promises that he's made about, especially about the economy, because you see these exit polls, a lot of people were voting on the economy. They saw him as a businessman who could do something about creating jobs, trade deals, all of those things. I mean, I think I saw in Michigan, union households had gone for Obama by 33% in 2012 and went by 16% for Trump this time. So they're expecting some results. They may not even like him. They may not like what he said. They don't. They're not white supremacists. They're just people that have lost their jobs or their factories have closed or they've watched jobs go to Mexico. They're expecting something to be done fairly soon. And if he isn't able to do that or gets, you know, tied up in all of the sort of things he gets tied up in, battles with Congress or personality conflicts or insults, then I think that there's going to be a fair amount of people that turn on him quickly. He may not have much of a honeymoon, and I think the closest of the election is good evidence that he didn't win this gigantic mandate to sort of stumble around for a while. He's going to have to get things done.
Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, and James Lynch commenting for us on the very new election results still being digested a couple days after people received the unexpected news that Donald Trump will be our 45th president. Jennifer Hemmingson here, my co-host at the Giving Tree Theater in Marion. Here's another question. Let me sort of wrap two questions into one because they both have to do with gender, which we definitely want to talk about because this is the first female nominee of a major party for president. A lot of people felt the U.S. Was ready for its first female president 240 years after the founding of the Republic, 96 years after the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. So the audience member writes here, I recently read 20% of Iowans don't feel we are ready for a female president. Do you think this attitude had a major impact on the election? To follow up, closely related, from another questioner, do you think who do you think will be the most likely female to make the top of the ticket in the future?
When you look at this election as a woman, I think you have this incredible pride and joy simultaneously with this horrible, I don't even know how to explain it, kind of like the stomach flu. I mean, it's kind of run both gamuts where nothing will diminish the fact that women have moved one step closer to claiming the highest office in this nation. Nothing diminishes that. Tuesday's election doesn't. And we need to remember that this was historic, whether or not Hillary Clinton got the win, whether or not a woman is in the White House, we have made great strides. Some of you know that I mentor journalism students, and I actually had a young woman stay after today to talk to me, and she's a young woman, a black woman from Chicago. Her family moved here a little over a year ago, and she's still not feeling comfortable in our area. And her question to me after class or after our talk was, are you going to quit now? And I had to ask her to explain and kind of go into more context. And she was worried that now that Clinton didn't reach this pinnacle, that suddenly all of us feminists, us people who are pushing for women to do better and equality, maybe we're going to curl up in the fetal position under our beds. I don't know what she expected. And I assured her that this is a fight that has been happening for more than 100 years, and it doesn't end here. And I have a lot of faith in the younger generation that eventually a woman will sit in the White House as President of these United States. And it's been a long time since I heard the question, so I think I have forgotten it, except for the fact that I'm supposed to predict which woman might move forward. We have some very strong women in both the Democratic and the Republican Party. I think it recently came out that Joni Ernst was actually approached as being the vice president and turned it down. And I know some of you, I hear kind of grumblings out there, but Joni Ernst is a very qualified, a veteran. and she cares a heck of a lot about this country. We could do a lot worse than a Joni Ernst sitting in the White House. On the other side, I think you have a Tammy Duckworth, you know, another veteran who just unseated a senator in Illinois. You have Elizabeth Warren, who has been a passionate person. But I think part of the problem is, you know, we have people who ran for office here in Iowa who will never run again, females, because of the way that they were treated, because of their cell phone numbers being put out on mailers, because of just horrible, hateful things. I think we really need to look at how we are going about these elections and hold people accountable for how they're behaving during the political process.
You know, I guess, you know, I have five sisters. I don't know that any of them would want to be president, but I think any one of them could do the job. I mean, I think that's not the – I sometimes think we're sort of post-gender nation. I mean, I don't know if people really look at can a woman do the job. Okay, I'm wrong. But, I mean, from the beginning, I had no question that Hillary Clinton could do the job. Was she the right person for the job? Did she have the right policies? Did she have the right platform? Those things come into play. And I think, maybe I hope, that young women who were part of that campaign and young women who look at this election and say, like, okay, we are, as Linda said, one step closer, we'll take the next step. They'll run for office. They'll get involved in the next campaign. I don't know who that next woman will be that will run for president. There are people out there who I think are qualified, who probably, I hope, aren't discouraged by Hillary Clinton's defeat, but will use this as a way to take the next step and keep the fight going. Because, hey, it shouldn't be a question.
Well, let me tell you what I've heard from women over the past 2 days. In addition to just being kind of flabbergasted about these election results, we have someone who looks at a Hillary Clinton with 30-some years in public office, obviously qualified to do the job she was running to do, who gets beat by a gentleman who arguably has no experience in the job that he wants to do. So the question becomes, if a woman that qualified and that experienced can't reach that threshold and actually gets denigrated for her experience and her qualifications, then where do women who don't have that, you know, how are they expected to move forward? And I don't know right now the answer to that question, and I don't know what to say to these women.
I want to posit a claim and have you either agree with it or shoot it down vigorously. Now that, Iowa has for some time, all the incumbents won are in Congress. We have five of six members serving in Congress who are with the GOP. Now we have a unified state legislature, governor, both houses of the legislature under the GOP. I'm going to posit that Iowa is no longer purple. It is red. Agree or shoot it down?
I think there are two things to watch here. One is the rural-urban divide, which I think is becoming more pronounced. If you looked at a map of Iowa, you know, the legislative districts, almost the entire state is red, except for Linn County, Polk County, Blackhawk County, Dubuque County, Johnson County. And it became slightly more red this year. So I think the challenge for Republicans is, you know, are they in tune with that rural, whatever rural voters are voting for? And I'm not sure that it's necessarily the same as what Donald Trump was campaigning on and what he was running on. The other thing is that when you look at Iowa voters, we've always talked about how there's this sort of split and there's this huge number of no-party voters. It kind of looks like no-party voters are Republican or at least Republican-leaning, that they probably aren't Democrats. And so, yeah, Ben, your point may be we are becoming red. I think it depends on the race. I think if there was an opening for a U.S. Senate seat, that it would be vigorously competitive, and there's no guarantee that it would be a Republican who would win it. the next governor. I don't think there's any guarantee that the next governor is going to be a Republican. But, yeah, I think it, sort of at the baseline, maybe we are more red.
Well, and I think a lot of those voters in the middle are prepared at any point to punish the party that they don't think is delivering. And, you know, if Republicans don't deliver, then you'll see a shift the other direction. I mean, we've seen this in a lot of our recent elections. It's less about, you know, what people are hoping is going to happen. They are just basically punishing people, candidates that they think are of the party or of the regime that isn't delivering, you know, what they're hoping. And a lot of it will depend on what President Trump does, what a Republican legislature does. If they get mired in sort of debates over things that seem trivial to those independent voters, or they don't get things done, or they're gridlocked, then those voters will render a different verdict. It's volatile, I think.
Well, it's been a wonderful evening here at the Giving Tree Theater in Marion with you, Jennifer Hemmingson, and all the others in the Gazette, James Lynch, Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington. If I may, Jennifer, one more question for our esteemed panel, now seated in a kitchen here. We're actually on a play set here at the Giving Tree Theater. One final question for Todd, Linda, and James. When the day comes in January that President Trump is inaugurated and he is handed the keys to the White House by President Obama, what will be the last words exchanged?
You got me. My Kenyan birth certificate's in the top desk drawer.
Oh, it's going to be hard to top Todd's answer there.
It is. The only thing I can come up with is goodbye and good luck.
All right.
And similarly, well, I think we learned that there are no keys to the White House when that guy jumped the fence and ran inside. But it might be a good idea to put a lock on that door. But I think it'll just be sort of God save the Republic.
Okay. Thank you all.
Yeah, well, we're going to find out in January. And I want to thank you all for coming out here, all the gang at Iowa Public Radio and Giving Tree Theater. And we want to thank you all for coming out here. And we'll see you next year.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks to the Gazette and all the people who made it possible. Thanks for coming out.
Coming up after a short break, we'll switch locations from Marion to Des Moines to hear more analysis of this historic election week and more about the shift in Iowa's legislature. My colleague Clay Masters talks with Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Kathy Obradovich of the Des Moines Register, and Kedron Bardwell of Simpson College. Excerpts from yesterday's IPR Election Hangover Happy Hour event in Des Moines. That's after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
This is Iowa Public Radio's Election Hangover Happy Hour at the Iowa Tap Room in downtown Des Moines, Iowa. I'm Clay Masters. I host Morning Edition. I'm also a political reporter who has been covering this election for quite some time now. So just to quickly recap the results, Donald Trump is now the president-elect. He got all of Iowa's 6 electoral votes. The Iowa State Senate has turned completely red. They have the majority now. All of Iowa's congressional delegation, the incumbents, they're going back to Washington. We're here with Kedron Bardwell from Simpson College, Rachel Payne Caulfield from Drake University, and Kathy Obradovich, a political columnist with the Des Moines Register. Welcome. So first of all, this is a hangover event, so we're a couple days. Hopefully the hangover's gone. But I want to know from each of our panelists, what was the first thing you felt or thought about this election when you woke up the next morning or when you just transitioned into the next day, starting with you, Kathy?
Okay. Well, I watched the returns until 2 a.m., so I already knew what was going to happen. I didn't wake up to any surprises. So my general thought in the next morning was, wow, let's get to work. I felt like, you know, a lot of times you feel this, oh, the election is over. The questions have been answered. And instead, we come out of this election with more questions than answers. And so for a journalist, that's exciting, and that's where the news is. And so I didn't feel like it was time for me to go to the beach. That'll be next month, maybe. But try to get the answers to the questions I think people have. And the first one is, what's going to happen now? I don't think we know that yet.
Rachel?
I woke up on Wednesday morning. I was also up until 2:30 or so, so I knew the result. But I woke up on Wednesday morning, and my first thought was, did that really just happen? I don't think any of us were expecting it. As a political scientist, I find it tremendously fascinating, and political scientists now have work to do for the next 100 years.
Kedrin?
Yeah, I think I was thinking a lot about Michigan. I used to teach in Michigan for a while, and so I was trying to figure out exactly what had happened there. So I started to kind of look at, I stayed up till 2:30. I spent most of the morning until about noon and didn't go in until after that, trying to figure out what had happened in Detroit, what had happened in the UP, what had happened in Western Michigan, those various areas that have very different political dynamics. So I was really trying to figure out, were these new voters that had showed up in those areas, or was it essentially just some former Obama voters that had switched?
And when you look at the votes from the different counties, you look at Polk County, which is where we are in Des Moines, if you look at Scott County out in Davenport, a lot of those went Democratic. That's where a lot of the urban centers, a lot of the growth in Iowa is. Rachel, does that surprise you with how much the rural vote came out and voted in this election?
So all across the country, we've seen this election cycle. If you go county by county around the United States and you look at how much the vote share for Republicans changed, there are rural counties all across the industrial Midwest where people turned out to vote at much higher rates than they have in prior elections. This was a campaign by Donald Trump that really energized and excited those voters, particularly white working class voters in rural areas, who feel as though their communities are changing, they're trying to make sense of a changing economic set of circumstances. And what they see in Donald Trump, they see change, but they also see an authenticity. They feel like he understands what they're going through, and he's willing to speak honestly about it. And I don't think they felt that way about Hillary Clinton. If you look nationwide at the numbers in terms of turnout, Donald Trump just about matched Mitt Romney's 2012 turnout nationwide. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton had about 5 million fewer voters turn out to vote compared to Obama in 2012. Not Obama 08, Obama 2012. So clearly there was an energized base of voters for Trump. And I should also note, many of them are not new voters, which is kind of what Trump had put forward, that there'd be this mad rush to the polls by a bunch of new voters to support Donald Trump. That does not appear to have happened, but we did see heightened turnout in a lot of these rural communities, not just in Iowa, but around the country.
Also, another big thing that set Iowa apart on the Republican side was just the major elected Republican leaders in the state. While other Republicans were distancing themselves from their Republican nominee, the governor, the lieutenant governor, both of the U.S. senators embraced him as the nominee. What do you think that means for Iowa moving forward because they embraced Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, I think that one of the reasons they did that is because Iowa elected officials feel a real responsibility to maintain the first in the nation Iowa caucuses. And was an underlayment of a lot of the things that they did going into convention, trying early to unify the party. They felt like Republicans felt that the caucuses were in danger after the party turned into a Ron Paul party for a while. They under Governor Branstad's leadership, they took the party back, they took the party apparatus back, and they determined, I think, that they were going to stand together. The other part of it was Terry Branstad. And the fact that his son was working as the Iowa state director for Donald Trump, I don't think anybody in the leadership in Republican Party necessarily wanted to step on Governor Branstad's toes by openly opposing Donald Trump. So those two reasons. And so what does that mean for Iowa? First of all, they extracted a promise from Donald Trump that Iowa would keep the first-in-the-nation caucuses. So that was important to them. Secondly, I think that he was forced to make some promises related to ethanol and some of the issues that are of regional importance here. Third, I think that we'll probably see Iowa Republicans show up in different places in the Trump administration, and perhaps some people that are pretty high up the ladder. So that'll be kind of interesting to see if some of those top Republicans end up working in the Trump administration.
Well, the governor was on stage with Donald Trump that last event in Sioux City, and he was saying, well, maybe we should put Terry in charge of trade, and he can take care of China. So who knows there? Rachel, how else would you come up with that question?
Well, I think Kathy's right in particular about the caucuses. I mean, this is clearly a bargain that's been reached so that Iowa can protect its status. I think, you know, there were a couple or two senators were openly supportive. At the lower levels, I found David Young's reaction really fascinating.
He said
he would be supportive of the Republican nominee. You didn't hear about it again for the most part. You'd go to his campaign events. He didn't affiliate himself. He didn't talk about it. And I think for some, you know, moderates and potential Democratic voters who might actually have voted for David Young, that may have detracted from support for David Young, but he did very, very well. And I think, you know, this is always a calculus that lower ballot races, candidates for lower ballot races, have to figure out in their heads, right? So on one hand, if Donald Trump voters are going to turn out to vote, and we have a straight ticket in Iowa, right? You can check that little box that says, I vote for all Republicans. So in some sense, that means if you're with the party, you're with the party.
You know, we're talking a lot about people wanted to vote for Donald Trump because they saw it as change. When you look further down the ballot and you look at the congressional races, Senator Chuck Grassley was called pretty much right as the polls closed. They're looking to change the president, but they're not looking to change their senators, their congressmen and women. You're all nodding at me.
Yeah, I think that's... You know, members of the House of Representatives who run for re-election have about a 95% re-election rate.
Right.
This is all across the board. Members of Congress don't get the same kind of scrutiny that presidential candidates do. And again, in Iowa and in states like Iowa that have that straight ticket ballot, incumbents do incredibly well in those systems. So, you know, I don't think, you know, for better or for worse, and the founders certainly intended that Congress was going to be the most important, most powerful branch of government. But for better or for worse, all eyes are on the president now. And everybody thinks that the president can do anything. And if you hear people talking about President Trump today, you would think quite literally that he rules the world. He doesn't. He's one part of a three-branch government. So, you know, people put all their attention, all their eggs in one basket. When they think change, and it's 2016, they're thinking president.
Kedren?
I just think if you look at the narrative of this anger, let's say, that the voters had, it's been all about declining trust in institutions. It's been about perceptions that the government was in the pocket of people with money. Trump took advantage of this to the largest extent he could, and so I think he was more in tune with the populist public mood than any of the other people that could have run on the Republican side, and Sanders on the Democratic side tried to take advantage of some of that as well. On the converse, I think there's something to think about in terms of that overall mood, which is forget Hillary Clinton, the name Hillary Clinton. Look at the rest of her resume. Look at who she's taken money from. In terms of the candidate that could be able to run well in a public mood that says, we want an outsider, the government is corrupt, she is probably the worst candidate on paper that the Democrats could have nominated. And I'm not saying that to be spiteful or mean, to take away her name. This was not the type of candidate that was right for what the public mood of change wanted.
And certainly one thing that did change in the state of Iowa that was really the biggest story that affects all of you is the makeup of the state Senate. There was a very slim majority the Democrats held there. Now it's a much larger majority. There's the, as my colleague Joyce Russell calls it, the trifecta. Republicans have the House, the Senate, and the governor's office now. What does that mean for the future of the legislative branch here in Iowa? Who wants to tackle that first? Do we need another drink first?
Yeah, what's it mean? It depends on what they decide their agenda is. I mean, there's been lots of discussion about how much to emphasize which issues, and we're going to have to deal with this on the presidential and congressional level as well, since there's unified government on the Republican side there. But there's a lot of leeway trying to figure out what issues you're going to emphasize. Is it going to be tax reform? Is it going to be lowering the corporate tax rate? Are they still going to follow through with some water quality funding? They disagreed on that last time, but will that be a priority now that they have all the strings, now that they have the Republicans have all sides of government? I'm not sure it will be, because when you have unified government, you tend to pull back to the base issues, I think, and try to find ways to get progress on the issues that are most important to your base. And so I'm hearing about legislation related to defunding Planned Parenthood or expanding and ensuring gun rights. I think those will probably be the issues that the base once addressed. Look, we put you there. Do it, is what I think the Republican base is probably going to say.
Kathy?
One-party control does not mean that the governor gets everything that he wants. Last time Governor Branstad had all Republican control was the last 2 years he was in office before he took his little hiatus before he came back. And one of his big centerpiece legislation was education reform. And the House and Senate, which were both Republican-controlled, did not play ball with him in a substantial way on that. The governor and legislators have different goals. And in particular, the governor and members of the House have different goals. House members have to run every 2 years. And so they are more sensitive to public pressure than the governor might be. And so they're not necessarily going to go way out on a limb sometimes with the governor. They are also more interested in exciting their base than the governor might be. So they might be going interested in going to harder social issues than the governor necessarily would be. When Democrats had control with Governor Culver, they passed a labor bill that they wanted to help labor unions, and the governor vetoed it, and everybody was shocked. Well, the governor had a different priority at the time than members of the legislature. So, I do think that if they come up with a shared agenda going into the session, they will be able to do some things. They just won't be able to do everything.
Would you come? Okay.
I would agree with what both of my colleagues have said. I mean, I do think there's kind of a poetic piece here to the final stretch of Branstad's administration, assuming he's not going to run again. He's right back where he was the first time around. He has a chance here to make some progress. I think on both the state and federal levels, divided government is relatively easy because you can blame the other side. Unified government, you got to work together. You got to figure out what your party stands for. You got to figure out what your common priorities are. And that can be a real challenge for a political party, and particularly today's political parties. Parties are going to struggle with this a little bit. But it also provides a measure of accountability that they're all very, very aware of. Anything and everything that happens, the voters know which party is responsible. So coming up with that common agenda is going to be essential.
We have Joe from West Des Moines. Who asks, are you worried about Iowa losing the caucus because of the weakness of Iowa Democrats? You know, we've been talking a lot about the Republican Party. The Democrats across the country, as well as here in the state of Iowa, have some rebuilding to do. I mean, first of all, to address this question, do you think the Iowa caucuses are going to be bruised at all, or are they going to keep their place? What are the Democrats going to be strategizing as they come here?
I don't think the caucuses will be bruised because Democrats are weak right now, unless Democrats fail abysmally more than they have in the past to find ways to rebuild. First of all, we've got a midterm election between now and the caucuses. And, you know, I think that Democrats already are starting to say, you know, that midterm election in 2018 could be really great for us if Trump is a disaster as president, or if the all-Republican majority in the Iowa State House is a disaster. So I think we've got some time between now and then. I think if Hillary Clinton had won, I think we would start seeing Republicans hanging around Iowa. After 2012, it took 11 days for the first Republican presidential candidate to show up in our state. I'm hoping we have a little bit more time, and I think we will have a little bit more time before we start seeing more Democrats coming through for the caucuses. But the party understands how the caucuses work. They understand there's a lot of resources here, and candidates who have run before have relationships and resources here. And also, nobody's been able to figure out another alternative to take Iowa's status away. So for all those reasons, I think the caucuses will survive this.
Yeah, Rachel? I think typically it's the party that loses the presidency that's most likely to revisit its nomination process. And when Democrats look around and they say, why did we lose this? You have a group of Democrats who say, we lost this because it wasn't Bernie Sanders. But I think on the whole, most Democrats who look around and say, why did we lose this? It's not because Bernie Sanders lost the Iowa caucus, right? He almost won it, number one. So the caucus system, when they talk about the system being rigged or they talk about dissatisfaction with the nomination process, it's not Iowa. It's a bigger party question about how the party's handling things like superdelegates. So in that sense, process questions are rooted into other areas of the process. And, you know, I think the Republicans, for the most part, Trump didn't win in Iowa, but they don't see, I don't think, a significant reason to revisit their nomination process right now.
Kathy, what kind of rebuilding does the state Democratic Party have to do after this election?
Well, they're asking themselves that question now. And one of the things they have to do is go back and really take a hard look at what happened, get beyond the emotion and look at the numbers, look at the data and see, you know, where things went well, where things didn't go well. I also think that they are starting to look at who are their leaders going to be. We've had a whole generation of leaders from Tom Harkin down now to Mike Gronstahl stepping off the stage. And I think that the party still hasn't figured out where that next generation of leadership is coming from. So that is going to be a big part of the process as well.
Rachel?
I would agree with that. I've been saying for a long time that I think the Iowa Democratic Party needs to do a better job of identifying who their next generation is. Who are the leaders of the next generation for the party? I think you have a lot of young activists in Iowa and Democratic politics who have come up through the Obama campaigns, and they have a very distinctive way of campaigning, I think. They're all about knocking doors and get out the vote. It didn't work so well for them this time. And so I think, you know, it's people as well as methods and figuring out as a party where they need to focus their time and attention.
All right, I have one question for all of you. Ooh. Regardless of what you felt about the election, by round of applause, are you happy that the election is over? There's a few people that aren't clapping. All right, this has been a lot of fun for me and for our panelists. Thanks so much to Kedron Bardwell with Simpson College, to Rachel Payne Caulfield with Drake University, and Kathy Obradovich from the Des Moines Register. This has been Iowa Public Radio's Election Hangover Happy Hour at the Iowa Tap Room. I'm Clay Masters. Go have a drink.
You've been listening to excerpts from yesterday's IPR Election Hangover Happy Hour event held in Des Moines. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our remote sound engineers, Jim Davies and John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.